Welcome to Access to Perspectives Conversations, the podcast for bridging academic landscapes. At Access to Perspectives, we provide novel insights into the communication and management of research. Our goal is to equip researchers around the world with the skills and enthusiasm they need to pursue a successful career. You will get insights around the topics of scholarly reading, writing and publishing, career development, project management and research integrity, all embedded into open science practices. Learn more about our work at accesstoperspectives.org.
Welcome back to the show, dear listeners. And we are here at Access to Perspectives Conversation. And I'm very happy to welcome today Ross Burnaby, who is a professor of research ethics and research integrity at the University of Oslo, Norway, and also an adjunct professor of medical research ethics at the University of Southeastern Norway. With her expertise and leadership, Rose is dedicated to advancing research ethics and integrity in various contexts and also serves as a project coordinator of several initiatives, one of which we are focused on today, which is ROSI, the Responsible Open Science in Europe project. And other than that, Rose, you're also engaged in a project that all of which have to do with research integrity and inclusiveness to varying extents. And yeah, but yeah, we will hear more about that from you. First of all, warm welcome and thanks for joining us today, Rose.
No, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for the invitation, Jo.
So yeah, let's get started in hearing a little bit. That's usually how we start the show, to hear how you have reached the current position that you're currently in. A little bit about your scholarly background, and and what you led to grow expertise and also now work in as an expert for research ethics and integrity. How did that come about?
Yes, okay. Just a little bit about me. I am a professor of research ethics and research integrity. But before being so, I did a lot of research on the ethics of medical research, clinical trials, different phases, but also on the inclusion of, for example, patients in the process of the governance of medical research. Now, so that's how I started. I did a PhD on the ethics of phase four clinical trials, this is, so when we talk about phase four, it's probably it's a very exciting area when we talk about medical research, because it's when medicine's already out in the market, but then you need to do research on them. You know, so it's not only about like it's not an issue anymore of is it safe and effective, but is it safe and is it safe and effective in the real world setting?
All right.
Yeah, so when we talk about real world, then we talk about much more variables, but also the possibility of more inclusion, mm-hmm. but also more complex ethical issues. You know, like there are things that we can do in a clinical trial that we shouldn't do in a phase four, and it was this that brought me to where I am now. I mean, you know, this whole issue of inclusivity of justice has always been a question that I have been interested in. After working on the ethics of phase four clinical trials, I moved into the whole issue of how medical research is governed in Europe. You know, looking into the role of regulators, in terms of oversight, but also how patient representatives, for example, are involved in the process. Mm-hmm. Now, so then, as you can see, this can easily be brought into the whole issue of what ROSI is all about, right? Of mm-hmm. doing research responsibly and doing open science responsibly.
What do you think makes us, from your perspective and your experience in medical and clinical research, A question that I often discuss with participants in courses and presentations is, why do we have to talk about open science today? And what are the constraints, some of which we are very much familiar with, like publication pressure, but also what, from a clinical perspective, what is the open part of open science? And particularly with Rosie. Sorry.
Yeah.
Let's try it out. I know this question is a bit broadly set, a bit broad set, like set broadly. Sorry. Maybe we can dissect together.
And so when we talk about openness in medical research, and it's also, maybe I would say like 20 years ago, right? And up to the present, we're still talking about patents. And we know that patenting means closing things, right? But then the whole issue of how of what can be opened in the process of clinical trials in spite of patents has been an ongoing discussion within the clinical trial field. So the whole issue of openness has been a, shall we say, a juggernaut, an issue of wide interest, but also of wide contention of what should be open and what does openness mean. Is it openness only in methodology, or is it also openness in terms of products? Is it openness in terms of provision of benefits to research participants, or is it also inclusion of patients, not only as research participants but also the possibility of them as being called as researchers? And if that is so, I mean, does this include bias? You know, so there, and of course, this extends to openness of data. Is it possible at all to open clinical data, right? So with data, for example, from, I don't know what, a scoping review of articles, openness there is no question at all. Right. So it's very easy to upload the data set from a scoping review of based on articles. But if you talk about personal data, such as your health data, say, is anonymity even possible? And if you anonymize them to such an extent that you minimize really re-identification, will this still even be useful? Right, so when it comes to medical research, these are, shall we say, still very sticky questions, you know, that we're still dealing with,
and also apparently need to be assessed on a project level, right? Like it cannot be generalized. Like we need checkpoints, as in like the FAIR principles for openness and reproducibility. Well, FAIR is, for those who are new to the terminology, is findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. And we come to talk about the reusability aspect as well. So it's about transparency, but also, like you said, at the same time, we need to protect identities and secure the data, and especially when it comes to personal data of patients and clinical samples that can identify an individual. So okay, let's start with Rosie as the project that's been going on for the past, was it 4 years?
Three years.
Yeah, 3 year project, Horizon 2020. And there, the mission was to co-create with related stakeholders novel practical tools to foster responsible open science and citizen science engagement. But that was not necessarily focused on medical and clinical research, right? It was cross-disciplinary. So maybe let's start with who was involved and engaged in the project, like who was the consortium? And then we'll talk about the results. What are the key takeaways? Or starting from the questions, which questions led the consortium to dig into the topic and bringing together citizen science with open science practices?
Yeah, so the question was, just to make sure that I understand, so you're asking how the consortium came about, or is it like what
no,
was the question that we're trying to answer? Or
either way, no, like who were the consortial partners in the
consortium? Okay.
And then how did the first year go about, basically to come up with the scope of the project and defining the targets, the targets for to work towards the results that we now have.
Okay, right. So consortium partners. So this was a project that was coordinated from the University of Oslo. But within Norway, we also have the University of Southeastern Norway. And then we have other partners, such as, for example, the Finnish Learn Society is a partner. We have CERES, an office from France. We have the Austrian Research Integrity Office. We have the University of Tartu. We have University of Porto. We also have the University of Latvia. We have EXA to represent citizen science.
Mm-hmm.
We have UREC to represent the Research Ethics Committee Network. We also have National Technical University of Athens. And then I might be neglecting. Hold on, 4, 5, 6. There might be some other partner that I'm neglecting now, right?
I think you mentioned all the
So we have these partners, and then at the first year of the project, of course, the first year is always the most uncertain, but also the most exciting year, when we were exploring, even digging further, what are these ethical issues? Oh, but not only ethical issues, what are these what are the legal issues, what are the societal issues, so on and so forth. But also, what are the differences in terms of preparedness for open science?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in between fields across disciplines, but also across countries within Europe, right? Oh, sorry, we also have we also collaborated with international partners, for example, partners from Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so. Of course, included the partners from all over the world as part of our advisory board.
Mm. So it's a Eurocentric but globally informed project. So
yes. So we were required to, of course, be Eurocentric.
Mm.
Yes. But at the
but
same
I didn't
time,
mean
we
this
did.
As a. I meant that neutrally, not as a.
I mean, you know, because then the money's coming from the European Commission, you know, so that by default makes it somehow Eurocentric.
Mm-hmm.
And we were part of the CSA call is really to develop a complement to the European Code of Conduct and Research Integrity, again, Eurocentric in that sense.
Mm-hmm.
But then we know that the impact of this will definitely goes beyond Europe, right?
Sure.
Because when you talk about open science, then how do we even delimit the boundaries or borders of it, right? So we have actively included stakeholders from abroad in our consultations. We included colleagues from Asia, from Africa, from Latin America, you know, so just to make sure that we're not producing something that is Eurocentric in a negative sense.
Okay. So that's even with the European partners is a lot to navigate, but was it clear, like basically, but let's focus on the outcomes or the pathway towards the outcomes. So if we look at the key results and takeaways from the project, which led to also a general guideline article or paper that you published with the team. So yeah, what would you summarize it with a few sentences? What are the key takeaways, one and the other, and maybe a few words around how those were achieved? And don't worry about mentioning all of them, because we're also linking the documents for further reading. But what's most important to you, as a, if that can be summarized, even as everything is of course relevant, and what's
it's very difficult to summarize or put our guideline in a nutshell, but same time maybe I can indeed say a little bit about it, right? So some takeaways, you know. So all right. So when we talk about guidelines on research integrity guidelines, so talk about like some of the basic values, and yeah, of course we take in the basic values of the UNESCO recommendation on open science, of ECOC, of DORA, of FAIR, of CARE, et cetera, of COARA. Right, you know, we take in all their fundamental values, but at the same time, what we need to understand is once you put all of these values together, you can always come up with, you can always have these values compete with each other, you know, conflict with each other, right? So the whole gargantuan task of ROSI is how to, number one, navigate how these values will guide the different aspects of open science. Right, and how to provide guidance in this navigation. So then that will consist of the several articles within the guideline. Now, an essential component in drafting the guideline, maybe several of our assumptions, or I think basic our foundations in the drafting would be the following. Number one, when we talk of open science, we cannot just think of researchers, right? So that's why, for example, the guideline begins with, after saying that we agree with the different guidelines, in 1.6, we say that national and European policies conducive to responsible open science are instrumental in signaling to researchers and research performing organizations the political commitments to support and promote open science. We cannot have responsible open science if we just put all the responsibilities on researchers, right? Mm-hmm. There's a huge political governance responsibility to set the tone, right? And the tone that's being set by on a governance level will somehow define, you know, how open science will be conducted in Europe and beyond. Right, so that's one. This is a consideration of equity, right? Mm-hmm. So as opposed to several other guidelines that create a lot of demands without specifying, the ROSI guidelines try to specify as much as possible what are the responsibilities of the different stakeholders, but also to set the tone by stating that, well, all of these things that we're saying here will be worthless unless we do have this political support for responsible open science. So I guess that's a very important one of the very important assumptions. A second important assumption is that different countries within Europe are also are prepared for open science in different levels.
Can you give examples of where the differences lie?
Yeah, so we have one publication, and I've gave them the link to that. Mm-hmm. They're different. So for example, there's a report deliverable entitled "Existing Policies and Guidelines on Open Science," and I have provided the link for this. You know, so if you look into how many countries have a national public policy in open science and open access, you know, like then we see that just a little over half have it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then if we look into how about national laws and open science and open access, then the numbers would even be much smaller, you know. So when we published this report, I think it was 2 years ago, only 5 of the 29 countries had national laws on open science and open access. You know, so that was, and how about national funder policy in open science and open access? Again, when we published this, there were more national funders who did not have a policy in open science and open access than there were that had policies.
Mm-hmm.
So on and so forth. But then maybe we can also look into, for example, how they differ in terms of how many of these, those that had national policies on open science and open access, how many of them mentioned FAIR? I mean, and we would be surprised that not all of them, in fact, mentioned FAIR. How many of them mentioned the term, even the terms research ethics and research integrity? Again, only not all of them, and actually fewer actually mentioned ethics and integrity. How many of them mentioned the need for an infrastructure? Many of them mentioned that. How many of them mentioned citizen science or had something to say about citizen science? Again, many do not mention citizen science over those that mentioned citizen science, so on and so forth. You know, so this somehow demonstrates how nations within, even within the European Union, are variably prepared on a policy level, at least, for open science.
All right. Okay, so with the focus of Rosie towards citizen science, can we dissect that towards how does it how does it relate to citizen engagement? Or did you agree within the consortium on a specific definition of citizen science in regards to open research? Like, what's
Yeah, so citizen engagement can still somehow be perceived as some sort of participant engagement, right? So but while citizen science really has to do with ensuring that citizens are not only engaged in your research, whatever that means, whatever that engagement means, but are engaged in a very specific capacity. That is a capacity as researchers in a research activity.
So,
right,
collecting data and contributing to the data collection, basically.
But even much earlier than that, even including them, for example, in the process of how do you call this? Designing your research. You know, thinking of the methodology, right? I mean, from the very beginning, it's not even just training them how to do the data collection, which we do, for example, to junior researchers, you know, but also engaging with them, making sure that a research proposal, for example, is very much theirs as it is ours. You know, so we saw citizen science as really seeing the citizens who are involved in research as on a researcher capacity.
Mm-hmm. So basically informed also for the scope, the benefits, the rewards of whichever capacity, and also consulted throughout the research project duration. And then inform
beginning to end up to and this of course has effects on authorship, as you've said, on the benefits of research, whatever that might be, you know. So yeah, and that's why it's so important to tread open science and citizen science carefully. Right, because we're talking about really a new way of how we involve citizens here. If we saw citizens before as participants, you know, now we have, I would say, even a much deeper respect for them, not only as sources of data, you know, but colleagues in their own right.
Like, doesn't being engaged or being engaged in a research project also require a responsibility to actively contribute. So what part of which what kind of citizens would be considered. And then now the extra challenge is across all disciplines. And did you identify cases and disciplines or project types that would not fit that pattern? So in other words, are the RUSI guidelines applicable without differentiation, or like broadly to all across all disciplines and research project types, or is it for a specific form of research that obviously engages? I'm asking this is a little bit of the devil's advocate question, but also at the end of the day, why do we do research? Like, whose research is for a global society which is made of citizens, and researchers are also part of that group. But now, with a specific, I mean, I'm also referring back to the UNESCO Open Science recommendations, because these explicitly encourage for an increase in citizen engagement. But then some researchers and research funders even would argue not all research is kind of designed to actively engage citizens, other than informing them about the output, which is often also a challenge in the first place.
Yeah, for sure. So we're not saying that all research projects or all funded projects should include citizen science, right? I mean, you know, so one, there are several areas now where you see a lot of citizen science engagement, for example, ornithology, but also a lot of activities from CERN, for example, now include citizen science, right? Or NASA, for example, now include a lot of citizen science. But also now we see a lot of research, for example, in the field of political science, include citizen science. Some type of medical research also include now citizen science. So how they're engaged would be variable, you know. So some really engage them as data gatherers, you know, and others also ecology is another booming area for citizen science, right? And we can understand why, because then we know that there is something about local knowledge that scientists would not necessarily have, right? So and citizen scientists have been involved in these different projects in different or in different degrees. Of course, the most widespread of them would be citizen scientists as gatherers of data, something like your junior researcher, right? But in other fields, they're more involved in the way, for example, that we talked about a while ago, in the creation of the proposal to up to being a co-author. Okay. Yeah. So in terms of applicability, I would say that there's really broad applicability. And if we think of academic fields as four broad fields, whether it's natural sciences, social sciences, the humanities, and the health sciences, we can imagine citizen scientists being involved broadly in those
in
four fields. But at the same time. For example, if a researcher is doing, I don't know what, a research that has single funds for this one researcher to reflect on, for example, the philosophy of Plato or Heraclitus or whoever, maybe there's no need for a citizen scientist there. Right, and the same thing applies to mathematical theories, you know, where you probably need only one, two, three persons to make such reflections on specific theories. Sure. Or think of, I have a colleague who calls it the wish which projects, referring to projects that cater to the fancies of philosophers, for example. You know, things, questions that they want to explore, and they probably want to explore it by themselves, right? So, citizen science probably not very relevant there, right?
But I see where you're going with this, because that's also something that I often ask, especially in the courses that I give on scientific writing or presenting. I work with the participants through a stakeholder analysis, where we, like in clinical research, it might be obvious, but where we like discuss in small groups also who are your actual stakeholders, not only as broad groups that you assume will eventually benefit from your research, but to make it as specific as possible. And then they often come up with groups that they haven't even considered, also by learning from other disciplines, where it's not common practice to consider certain groups, like, I don't know, like patients or citizens, really, to benefit directly from a research output when you're studying nuclear physics. But if they then go through, okay, from basic research, what are possible applications downstream, which based on what has already been found in my field, then they quickly learn and also come up with stakeholders that they haven't considered before. And that also adds to the motivation in going to work every day in such repetitive and demanding environments. So it's quite exciting and rewarding also for the researcher to consider actual human beings, and also within the family, to discuss with family, friends, and make the research, which otherwise is quite detached from real world scenarios, applicable and approachable to your friends and family. So that can be quite exciting.
So here, for example, in Norway, there's a citizen science organization called Migrant Citizen Science Association. You know, so then now, because like we talk about, for example, citizen science in scientists in Europe, but then maybe sometimes most of the time migrants feel excluded from that process. so now with the inclusion of such an association in research projects, so now we hear not only from citizens. Right, because who is a citizen? Do they need to be legal citizens? You know, but also from those who have most of the time felt excluded in projects that actually affect their well-being.
Mm.
Right? So there's really a lot. I think citizen science can be very powerful. I mean, it's the wrong direction to say citizen science should be included in all projects, but at the same time, there's really a lot of, as you've said, it can be very inspiring and also very powerful to include citizen science and projects that really matter to them.
Yeah. A typical group to include as citizens in cultural studies is communities and even indigenous groups or indigenous peoples countries that are usually outside Europe. While we also have communities and traditional communities inside Europe, which it's a debate that's not often had by people unless you're studying European communities. So and there are a few guidelines, but it seems that I've come across, and also with colleagues who are, we are currently developing or collecting guidelines that exist for research engagement with communities. Do you see parallels, or has this also been part of the ROSI project to engage communities when it comes to cultural studies versus citizen engagement of communities or certain groups in Western industrialized societies?
So if we have explored, so the question is if part of the ROSI project was to explore differences in terms of engagement in terms of
Yeah, I think the
Aboriginal
question that
societies,
I
for
have,
example,
and
or
I'm not sure if there's an answer to that. So, is it what different types of communities exist when it comes to citizen science?
what
Is
kinds of
or is
yeah,
it
it's
often like any individual who considers themselves as a citizen as referred to a research project? This is a whole community or group of people within a society.
yeah, but because, well, yeah, so Dev, I guess I agree with you that there's no one answer to it,
Yeah.
because even those of us who are researchers can be citizen scientists, right? So, for example, I do a lot of research in within the field of medical ethics, right? Medical research ethics, but if I will be acting in my capacity as someone who lives in this particular area in Norway, looking at like which birds are present at which time, then I'm obviously not acting as a scientist. I'm obviously acting as a citizen, right? Because that's not my area of specialization. And also, and how many permutations of that can we make? Right? So I guess we can only broadly talk about groups of people. So we talk about, for example, Aboriginal people as opposed to those who are not, people of a specific color in a country, and those without such who are not considered colored, so on and so forth, people of specific ethnicity. But as I said, anyone and everyone can have the potential to be a citizen scientist. Now I'm of course thinking while I'm saying all of these things. It's like because one thing about open science means epistemic justice, right? Means opening our what we mean by knowledge beyond what we defined as knowledge earlier. So we're opening ourselves to new knowledge systems. And if we think of citizen science and open science in that direction, well, what limitations do we have in categorizing who is a citizen scientist and who isn't? Right. So, and because it's so broad right now, as we stress, for example, in the ROSI guidelines, it's very important that we do this in a very systematic fashion, but also in a very with a very equitable spirit. And giving some responsibilities, for example, on the side of the academic researcher or the institutional researcher, to make sure that citizen scientists are included properly, but also trained properly, so that we don't, well, yeah, we don't replicate bad practices of inclusion of citizen scientists, because it can also go in a very wrong direction. So I don't think we can come up with categories or give like a list of categories. It's quite difficult.
I think, yeah, it's probably also again very specific to the research scope and who's involved in the research, as in practicing researchers, and what the research questions are, and then who to consult as citizens. Yeah. Oh, interesting. It's complex, but I think also always when we consider the project level, it can be quite clear. It's like with the FAIR principles, there's a lot of conversations about the FAIR principles on the meta level, and all the stakeholders except the researchers agree that FAIR principles must be applied. But then the descriptions and what FAIR means are so broadly defined that for a researcher who's now exposed with, oh, you have to do, make your data FAIR. It's like that's also a question I often get when I introduce FAIR as a concept. It's like, okay, but I don't know how that applies to my data. Like, and then we have to actually sit down and work through the whole process and assess what data types did you collect, how much of that, what different formats, is that even publishable? Where has it been archived so far? Is it is necessary to anonymize the data, as you said in the beginning? Like there's so many components, it's quite complex but necessary. And at the end of the day, like my take and how I introduce open science usually is We're talking about good scientific practice and research integrity, and every researcher, I assume, we all want to comply with it. Like we, like most, if not all of us, have the best possible intentions. Why is that so difficult? That's an open question. Well, there are several pressure points. First of all, it's also complex. Then we have this publication pressure. You mentioned the necessity, or you highlighted from the guidelines that came out of the ROSI project, that the incentive system is key to enable researchers to practice open research in the first place. And for that, we need to ease the publication pressure, but still hold each other accountable. And one way to achieve that is through fair data processing, obviously making the research data fair and engaging for various stakeholders, including citizens, to various extents or various, And then the researcher carries still a lot of responsibility, but also has a unique position in exploring a new field of knowledge. But then the responsibility is who, like now that if we have this knowledge, who can benefit and how can we protect from ourselves and others from possible harm that comes out of that knowledge? Like that can basically, how can, if the research can possibly be misused by, and when we look at research or basically data security, that individuals be harmed, or like we've seen, if certain political actors get hold of military research data, then they, you know, that has whole other consequences which actually affect peace or well-being in certain parts of the world. So there are quite some implications that, and the question is like, who carries the responsibility? I hope it's not only the researcher, but the researcher has probably the widest possible knowledge about a research topic that they're exploring.
Who carries the responsibility for?
Yeah, for making assessments for reuse and possible harm out of sharing the research. As much as we want to make our research outcomes accessible, there's also the danger of misuse through reuse.
For sure. But isn't that, I mean, so one thing when we talk about, so when we talk about who's responsible, you know, for ensuring fairness, I guess, right? So, I mean, one thing about open science is we also create new jobs for because then who safeguards fair? I mean, now we're talking about different actors safeguarding fairness, institutional or otherwise, right? So it's not just the researcher now. We're talking about different actors now who safeguards fairness. So definitely the researcher still has some kind of a leading role in making decisions there. But when it comes to safeguarding FAIR, I mean, now there's really, we talk about infrastructures, we talk about new jobs, you know, to ensure that. Right? So
data managers and data security officers. And in some institutions, these already exist. And it's a matter of capacity and funding opportunities, but also is a research topic even so prone to bring about threats to society? And most research, I would guess and hope, is not. So in most research activities, we're pretty much safe. And those that carry certain threats can then, through also the FAIR principles, by applying FAIR principles and assessing possible threats and making risk assessments of some of any sort, security measures in place. But it all comes down to what ROSI and other open science initiatives is all about. We need a certain level of transparency and also accountability to be able to make these assessments in the first place, to benefit society.
We need real structures, you know, to make open science really responsible. I mean, like, yeah, on the one hand, we now have a lot of infrastructure, as we said, and different sets of people, whether it's a data protection officer, so on and so forth, you know, but there's also, as you've said, there's always the persistent risk of dual use, right? And I guess this is bigger in some fields than others. So think, for example, of the natural sciences, you know, so there's always some studies would really, you know, some fields would really have that much bigger threat. And who's safeguarding that? So if we have all experience applying for grants, right? And one of the ethics questions is there the risk of dual use? And this is just a declaration, yes or no. Mm-hmm. So if you put in no, will there be second, third set of eyes that will ensure that there's really no dual use risk of the research, right? So it becomes,
but that's also,
and whose responsibility it is to do that.
And isn't that also what peer review is there for, to identify potential risks where the acting researchers have not seen those or disclaimed those? There's also a matter of peer review, and where open science and open peer review is applied, the community at large or wherever, anyone has a chance of flagging researchers potentially risky, and then it can be withdrawn if need be. So there's also,
yeah, but this when it comes to inclusion of the community in the process, at least what we have now, community inclusion comes at the end. Like, for example, in publications, mm-hmm. or when research products are already out somehow in the open. Mm-hmm. But at certain instances, that can already be too late, right? Especially mm-hmm. if you talk about dual use, you know? So dual use needs to be, the oversight of that really needs to begin at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. It can't be not when there are already research products to talk about. You know, so on the one hand, we already have a lot of structures, and we said different countries have different degrees of robustness in terms of structure, infrastructure, in terms of specialists or on the other hand, there are real issues that should go beyond the national level. So when you talk of dual use, this cannot, especially if it's funded by, for example, by the European Commission, it goes beyond individual national interests, right? So because then that can be a risk that goes beyond just the citizens of one nation, you know. So and who's safeguarding that? How is open science even like the sufficient safeguard for something like this? So
yeah, I think, well, let's hope it can be as we're advocating, but I think we agree that as much as openness is key, at the same time also accountability and security and safety is, of course, goes hand in hand. And the more stakeholders involved, the better we can take care of all the aspects to consider.
Yep.
And the more standards are developed and tested in whichever regional, national, and global applicability, leaving room for flexibility and adaptation, being adapted to specific use cases. So I think we already have something to revert back to in each research discipline. And there's also opportunity to explore and develop further. And that's the exciting part about the research process in the first place. I'd like to, like, maybe with two or three sentences, what's next after Rosie, that's now coming to an end as a project? Is there plans for a second iteration of the project or continuation in a similar setup, or what's your next adventure?
Yeah, so Rosie ended like end of February, But the work of Rosie is far from it being ending. Yeah, so because we do have many other things that we promised to ourselves we will accomplish beyond the deliverables we have stated we will deliver. All deliverables have been delivered. But at the same time, we're still working on, so there's what, there we have training materials on responsible open science, you know, and these are openly available in the NERI classroom and the Rosie Knowledge Hub. We also have a Knowledge Hub. But then we still are developing, number one, a MOOC version of the training materials. So our training materials are divided into different fields, plus also one for citizen science. Now we're developing the MOOC version of that. So that should be coming maybe hopefully by the end of this year. We also have like the Responsible Open Science ebook. Mm-hmm. Maybe also hopefully that comes in, if not late this year, early next year. You know, as you know, we were present in the parliament, so this whole push for responsible open science will continue in different fronts. Alea just confirmed to us that they are endorsing the ROSI guidelines, and that will also entail some work, you know, in terms of, in terms of not only for pushing for more use of our guidelines, but maybe in the future also the process of, you know, any relevant guideline should be a living guideline. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we need to talk about like the process of revising, for example, the ROSI guidelines after a few years, so on and so forth. So the work of ROSI, even if the project has ended, the work is really far from finished, right? So of course we hope to continue doing our work with funds, in the future. But for sure we will be you will still continue to hear more of the responsible open science work.
Yeah. From us. Thank you so much for the conversation and the insights, and also for putting all the work with the team into the ROSI project and the outcomes and the guidelines. We will, of course, share any the reports and materials and the toolkit as they are released with the network, and possibly also do a follow up conversation upon their release to introduce. And yeah, thank you so much, and all the best for the next stage.
Yeah, thank you very much, Joe. Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us to listen to this episode. Do let us know what you think. You can email us or connect with us on our social media channels, which you can find on our website at accesstoperspectives.org. Email us at info@accesstoperspectives.org or book a call to explore how we can support you with your research planning, management, and publishing. Welcome you again soon for our next episode. Until then, have a great time.